Welcome to the show today. Hope you enjoyed this one. Now, in this episode today, I'm talking with Will Remore. I had a conversation a couple of weeks ago with Will as he reached out to me on LinkedIn, curious to see if anyone in the financial services industry was actively exploring or open to ways to utilize blockchain technologies, NFTs, and decentralized financial solutions in their business. Now, don't worry, I barely understand most of the stuff also, but I know in time it won't really matter how it all works, it just matters that it does work. Now, if you're wondering what the next big thing could be with respect to investing, you may actually be surprised to learn it could be as simple as investing in debt. Now, in the show notes, I've collated some episodes and inserted links to them to make it easy for you to connect the dots around what I'm thinking here. Central bank issued digital currencies, digital identities, NFTs, Bitcoin, stablecoins, modern monetary theory, and what we're covering today. It's all part of something that I feel is really important to try to get your head around. If you're a self-directed investor, I think it's critical to understand the sandbox that you're playing in. It's simply not just about easy access to markets that you couldn't access before for low fees. At some stage, you should be thinking about how to manage your investment risks, especially if you're building serious levels of wealth. And also how to structure your investments in such a way that you can hold them long term during all sorts of ups and downs without freaking out. Now, I cover a bit of content like today that's perhaps not typical for finance or investment topics on a podcast. Occasionally, you'll need to think a bit and try to understand things on a different level. As you know, I'm not afraid to cover topics that I barely understand myself, and the reason why is simple. No matter where you're at in your understanding of economics or how business works or how different types of markets all affect each other, I think it's super important to test what you hold as being true. It's not about proving to others what you know, it's about being able to make decisions that you can be confident in. And that confidence, no matter how much of it you think you have, will get tested soon. The world is changing, and it's changing so fast, but I'm not sure that our understanding of it's really caught up and been updated yet. For example, we're now investing in a world moving towards more centralization and coordinated planning at pace. This changes things big time. All the while that's happening, intense innovation in the decentralized and collaborative digital realm is just getting started. If you like, the last limping remnants of the free market have jumped dimensions to where freedom still exists and is flourishing. The more control stifles life here, the more freedom creates innovation there. And that's not something that I'd scoff at. And that leads me to today's topic, democratizing debt. You can now invest all over the world through online investment platforms like you never have before, but for the most part, you're investing in companies, you're investing in equity. Investing in the debt market isn't really as accessible or as exciting as I think it will be soon. I want to take it slow through this discussion today with Will. I've already spoken to him at length just planning today. Then we did the recording session and then I edited it and listen to it again. And I think I'm starting to get it. Now, it's not that it's hard to understand necessarily, but you need to listen to all of the building blocks really well before you get the essence of the overall story. So what are we covering? Here's what we're covering. I'm going to give you the six bullet points. Balance sheet basics, balance sheets for financial services, the 101 on lending, like how does it work from a bank's perspective, how financial services uses this thing called securitization to help fund lending activities, and how to bring that securitization on chain via non-fungible tokens, NFTs. Lastly, how decentralized finance creates an additional source of liquidity, which diversifies the funding base and reduces systemic liquidity risk. Wow, right? Don't worry if those last two things sound a little bit abstract. It will all make sense, I promise. Now, if not, just keep on listening to this like I do. Now, before we start, just a couple of quick things. Please be understanding of the audio quality today. I'm really looking forward to getting back in the studio soon, but as you'll see, the audio suffered a little bit on this one. I tried my best to edit it. Now, lastly, I've split the episode into two parts. This is part one, and we're covering just the building blocks today. Next week, we'll talk about where this is all leading. All right, I hope you enjoy this. I feel really privileged to speak to Will today, someone who knows not only about how retail banking works in New Zealand from the bank's perspective, but also how it could work in the not-so-distant future. Enjoy. The NZ Everyday Investor Podcast, a podcast series designed to help you, the everyday Kiwi, build new wealth in the new world that we're heading into. My name's Darcy Ungaro. I'm your host and qualified financial advisor. Managed funds, property, shares, crypto. Whether you're investing for your retirement or saving for your first home, I explore anything and everything, mainstream or alternative, that can help you on your way. If you're into thinking for yourself and you have a desire to grow wealth, then you've come to the right place. Extra insights and information on today's show can be found by tapping or swiping over the cover art in your podcast player. Here you'll find some show notes, which will contain all relevant links related to today's topic. While you're there, be sure to sign up to the newsletter and follow the show across all social media channels, including YouTube. Investment options and strategies discussed on the show may not be suitable for all investors. Please be sure to conduct plenty of your own independent research and ideally obtain advice before acting on anything discussed. Hope you enjoy the show. Now, Will, for the benefit of our audience, can you just describe to us what it is that you do and maybe give us a little bit of a lowdown on your background?
My background, originally I came from a banking background, working in quantitative risk functions at banks here in New Zealand, ASB Bank, and also had a stint in Westpac Bank, both in credit risk departments. And I've always been passionate about open data, open environments. So that led me from about 2016, 2017 to get involved into some of the initiatives that were being explored by the bank around blockchain and distributed ledger technologies. That was the first, my first inroad into that ecosystem. The projects that I was working in the banking at the point in time was around sovereign digital identities, because it was a key problem that banking counterparties had around how to reinteract with distributed ledger technologies where things actually work mostly anonymously, right? So that was the first inroad. From there, people that I was working with in that experimentation within the innovation lab of ASB were actually my future employers. So I went from there to work with like an extremely smart group of people from blockchain labs, which was smart contract security auditing, operating here from New Zealand, but actually mostly for overseas clients. So that's where I got in touch with people from the Silicon Valley, Singapore, and different very smart groups of engineers. And then over the last couple of years with blockchain labs, I joined the biggest DeFi project in the world, which is called MakerDAO.
You started out in traditional mainstream banking, but doing kind of interesting sort of, we'll call it experimental stuff, if you like. Now you've been set free, you're in the wild, and you're collaborating with a lot of other people, a lot of very, very smart people. You're working with MakerDAO right now. We've mentioned this on the show ages ago, and I kind of just touch on these things every now and then. But what I'd love to do with you today is just go through a bit of a step journey towards a little bit about how the banking system works right now from a bank's perspective a little bit, and then how decentralized finance can potentially change everything. So today we're going to be kind of throwing words in there like decentralization, distributed ledger technology, NFTs, securitization. And I'm going to ask you to do your very best to educate me and our audience as to what these terms mean. So should we start off with maybe some balance sheet basics just to get the ball rolling, Will?
I think at the basics of everything that we do in terms of like banking and financial services is this idea of the ledger, right? So that incredible innovation that was the invention of double system accounting back in the times of the merchants of Venice that actually had to record how they did their things in this ledger so that they could always have like a version of truth to come back to. And in that sense, that's the basics of how every single commercial bank across the globe has its main requirement is actually to maintain that. But in terms of like the balance sheet, the idea here really is not hugely unfamiliar to anyone, being it from the financial services or from anyone that has got like a business. Essentially, you've got these two sides of the balance sheet, right? You've asset side and you've got like a liability side on the balance sheet that both of them have to be balanced. If your liability side is lower than your asset side, then it means that essentially your business is solvent. So that doesn't really change, be it in a financial services company or in any company that actually needs to maintain a ledger. That's really the basics of what we're talking about when we talk about distributed ledger technology.
Okay, so the balance sheet basics, you know, your assets needs to be balanced by your liabilities, and if something's out of whack, you're either solvent or insolvent, and obviously we want to be solvent. So this is obviously really important from a banking perspective because they need to be solvent, right? So when we kind of think about this in the context of financial services, do you want to kind of just take that even further and just talk to me about some of the nuances that we see there?
Absolutely. So when we talk in the financial services context, it's an even more important financial responsibility, right? Because the normal business that is out there, if like a business does tiling or construction, building, trades or so on, if that business, that single business actually go insolvent, and assuming the business is not too big, they won't necessarily have a huge impact on the economy overall. It's mostly like a problem for that business or for that sector or that industry. And considering their size, the economy will not be down unless they're just a drop in an ocean of bankruptcies, essentially. When it comes to financial services industry, it's a very different story because these are essentially gatekeepers and representatives of the overall health of an economy. And that's why you have, you know, different tiers of this financial services. You have the non bank, essentially, like in from a central bank perspective, you've got the two big groups, which is authorized deposit taking institutions or the banks. You've got the non bank group. But on the, say, if you take from the example of like the big financial institutions, they are considered big because also they have financial systemic importance, right? So in here in New Zealand, put things in practical terms, you've got the big four banks of New Zealand. So ANZ, ASB, BNZ, and Westpac, and they account for a significant share of the economy, right, in terms of their relationships with the end users and so on. So on a financial company, you have, again, so you have the asset side and the liability side. And for our bank, what they essentially have on their asset side is their loans. They lend to the market and they collect an interest on that, actually, that loan they advance to households and individuals. On the liability side, they have essentially their cost of capital, right? For example, either your customer deposits. So you've got your money in the bank, and that's a deposit, and that's what the bank essentially uses to finance its asset side. And as for any other business, they have to have a balance between that asset side of the balance sheet and the liability side of the balance sheet. And they need to make sure that they make a spread between their cost of capital on the liability side, so the debt side, how much that they actually paying for you for your term deposit or for your savings account. And on the other side, how much they are charging customers on the loans, the mortgages, the credit cards, the personal loans that they have on the asset side. And the balance between those two defines essentially the profitability of that financial institution, right? And on top of that, on the equity side, certain requirements of a minimum capital that they have to have on the table that is prescribed by the central bank, how much capital, what you call like regulatory capital, that they have to have there as a buffer for risks in case of stress scenarios.
So like if we go back to that example where there's a tiler or a builder and they go under, obviously that poses a problem to the bank because they're defaulting on some lending perhaps, but the reason why there needs to be some capital reserves tucked away as well is because if there's some broader systemic risk like an economic correction or meltdown or a recession of some sort, regulators need to make sure that the banks are solvent at all times, right?
Essentially, yes, because if the bank is not solvent and the regulator has only as much insurance essentially to cover for the insolvency of a big financial institutions, what that means is actually that customers could lose the money that is actually in the bank. We've had this, for example, during the European debt crisis of 2012, where I'm sure lots of your listeners actually have looked over the newspapers and said, actually, Greek banks have actually put capital controls. So essentially what they were trying to prevent is that all of those customers would actually withdraw all of that money that actually were in the bank accounts. Because if they did, essentially the bank wouldn't actually have all of the capital there, because as for example here, it's actually financing itself through the customer deposits and using those customer deposits actually to be able to lend. So actually the cash is not there if every single one of them were to ask for their cash to be withdrawn, because all of that money has been redeployed elsewhere. And the only things that actually are the remaining are the locked capital that the banks had to lock with the central bank for regulatory purposes. So they have like a minimum requirement. In the case of New Zealand here, New Zealand and Australian banks are amongst the most well-capitalized banks on the globe. So they have capital requirements that are way higher than European and American banks.
Yeah, and I guess it kind of makes sense on a level, right? Like if you think about the money as stock, and the banks charge a margin on that stock, and then they sell that to their consumers. It's just the stock on hand, right? So naturally, they need to have liquidity. They need to have sources of funding, diversified source of funding, so that there's resiliency no matter what's going on in the market, so that they can always be in a position to provide credit, which is the lifeblood of any economy. Do you want to maybe just take me through the 101 on lending, just to break it down for someone, say, for example, who has a mortgage? Like, I know that a lot of people, they don't really care what happens behind the scenes as long as they get their money from the bank and they understand what the terms are. But do you want to just break down that 101 down for us a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. Say you're a young couple, and you're about to buy your first home, right? So essentially that young couple will say, we identify the house in the market that he wants to buy. The bank on its side is essentially maintaining a view of the valuation of every single house that is out there in the market. So that's why they, you know, buy information from the likes of data brokers like CoreLogic and so on, and maintain actually that constant valuation of the market. So when you come to buy the house, you go to the bank and say, hey, I've identified house X can actually buy. That's how much I'm paying for the house. So that's what is your offer under the sales and purchase agreement. Actually, the bank would say, okay, cool. It's roughly about the same valuation that they have for that house on their books or on the data broker services that they have access to. And they would say, okay, you need to bring on top of the value of the house, you have to bring, say, 20% cash, just in case the bank offers you the loan and the market crashes the following day, it will essentially be already negative. So although real estate is the very solid market, banks are fairly cautious, and particularly in situations like what we are right now. So the borrower essentially says, okay, here's my 20% deposit, which the bank then unlocks that facility and lends that money to the borrower to do the settlement on the house. So, and the bank doesn't stop there, right? So they now keep on monitoring that the value of that house that was lent to the couple over time, and uses that on its internal calculations in its internal position, because in that case the borrower is over-collateralized, because they have, from the bank's perspective, the borrower has both the value of the house, say $1 million, and the top-up of $200,000 on top of that. Even though the house is valued at $1 million, the bank effectively has $1.2 million on its balance sheet because of that LVR ratio. Up until that point, the bank hasn't got to the financing of that, right? Because it's using, as we were saying before, is using the cost of deposits or the issuances that it does in the market to be able to finance that loan for that borrower. And that's where things actually get really interesting from a funding perspective, because the bank needs to be able to continuously underwrite all of those loans.
So what you're saying is that there's like a contract that happens between the borrower and the lender, and in exchange for a series of regular payments going back to the bank over, say, 30 years, the bank is happy to give an amount equal to 80% of the purchase price, $800,000. On the books of the bank, there's $1 million security, and they know that it's over-collateralized because the borrower has put in $200,000 cash deposit. Going back to what you were just saying before I interrupted you there, like that has to be repeated over and over and over again. So presumably it sucks a lot of capital out of the bank, right?
And the bank then sells, although the bank in this case here is the lender, right? So they are the lender to that borrower. The bank has to itself finance its own activity, right? So that's the other side. So they use a lender to the lender, in which case they use at least two of them. So one of them are the you and me, and business and households that are just essentially having their cash in the bank's balance sheet. And the other ones are parties like the central banks that essentially allow the bank actually to have a liquidity facility against which the bank itself takes those mortgages and pledges to the central bank. Right, because they say like, yeah, I've got those mortgages here. This is the amount of capital that I've got on my asset side of my balance sheet, and they pledge that to the central bank to be able to have a financing line. And that's not the only thing, but the bank has got to have essentially that balancing act, because from a liquidity perspective, because they have short-term payments that need to go through those moms and pops that have their cash on the bank. Those are short-term liabilities. And on the other side, they have long-term assets that they need to finance, like the mortgage, that is the 30-year-old mortgage. So it needs constantly actually to be able to find ways where the difference, the delta difference in terms of time between those short-term needs and then long-term actually revenue streams are well balanced out.
This is interesting. Yeah, so this is kind of interesting, right? Because there's a mismatch, right, between durations of that. So there must be a lot of internal sort of jiggery-pokery going on all the time to make sure that there's balance happening, not just in the assets and liabilities, but in this stream of all these payments going back and forth, right?
Exactly. Absolutely. And that's usually managed by the treasury departments of a bank. And the chief financial officer of a bank is actually treasury that is managing that liquidity. In the case of like a commercial bank, like the ones that we have in New Zealand, right?
Okay, that's cool. Hopefully we've built up a little bit of a baseline understanding now for our listeners, just so that we can kind of make a bit of another step forward here and talk about this concept called securitization. Is it cool if you kind of just talk me through what that is?
Yeah. So now moving on from that mom and pop borrower to the bank and their relationship to the bank. Now let's move on to the next side, which is essentially who is the lender to that bank. So the idea of the securitization here to make, again, bringing back to the principle that the bank needs to have always that liquidity to be able to provide, you know, credit to the market. Banks have two main sources of capital. So one of them is the one that we talked about, which is the cash deposits from the moms and pops and businesses. And the second one is the wholesale market. In the wholesale market, there is a whole bunch of different players that actually can act in that wholesale market. The wholesale market, again, you have both short-term wholesale and you have long-term wholesale. You can have like short-term maturities and long-term maturities. But from a bank's perspective, now the bank has got those assets on its balance sheet, and they have two ways of financing themselves mostly. Like I'm oversimplifying here just for the sake of the example. One of them, and it's very common in Europe, covered bond structure, where the bank essentially keeps the loans on its balance sheet and pledges those loans that are on its balance sheet on to investors that actually invest into, say, a bond backed by those loans that stay in the balance sheet of the bank.
It's almost like they're providing a security instrument on those assets without them leaving their balance sheet, right?
Essentially, yeah. So that's essentially so, and they are also having those investors that buy those notes, essentially bonds that represent that pool of assets. They are essentially buying both the security that is pledged and actually the counterparty risk itself. because they stay on balance sheet. So it's actually still associated with the credit quality or the quality of that counterparty bank, right? So it's they have both risks that are associated there. The second case, which is a off balance sheet, it's where the bank actually takes those assets that it's got onto the balance sheet, so essentially like those loans, so real estate, let's make the example, and packages them up, sells them essentially to an off-chain structure, like an SPV, so a special purpose vehicle, and then that SPV to finance itself issue those notes into market. Again, in the case of a true securitization that is off balance sheet, those loans are no longer in the bank's balance sheet. They have been sold.
So just to break this down, make sure I'm understanding this. So these assets, and from the bank's perspective, an asset might be your mortgage. So we might look at that as a liability, but from the bank's point of view, that's an asset. It's a stream of incomes coming in. So that gets packaged up. That goes into a special purpose vehicle, an SPV. And then there's some bonds issued to the market on that SPV. Is that what you said?
That's right. And there's the cash flow. There's the cash flow stream from the interest that actually is paid on those loans. And that cash flow stream is essentially the yield that those investors that are buying those bonds or those bond notes are getting. But not only from one loan, but from a whole heap of different loans. And that's what we call the RBS markets, residential mortgage-backed securities.
So we have this process of securitization that's going where effectively it just gets packaged up and then it gets sold on to institutional investors. Maybe they're providing an opportunity for other investors to get the benefit of what they're doing. Is that the idea?
Essentially the idea. And there is also like another element to it, which is the aging of those assets, right? So you know that actually as an asset age in the bank's balance sheet, and they start, so that the size of that loan, say, when you started with those, going back to that example of the $1 million house, the size of that loan was very significant, right? So if you think from the point of view of the investor that has an equity in the bank, the return on his equity is significant in the early stages of that asset in the loan, in the balance sheet. The customer is paying off that loan, the size of that cash flow is reducing more and more, but the bank is still keeping actually that loan on its balance sheet. Say that mom and pop that had the $1 million facility with the bank, and at the very beginning, they had like a very high LVR. So the bank was getting a lot of cash because the size of the loan was significant. But as time goes on, and the maturity actually gets closer and closer to the end of the term, the actual return that have maintaining that loan on the bank's balance sheet reduces. And if you think about, say, an investor, someone that has got shares in that bank, actually the return on the equity from those maturities that are much closer to their term is actually it reduces over time. So that's one of the ways that the bank does to also promise a higher return on equity is actually to take those assets off its balance sheet and actually put into those securitization vehicles. So that actually then those investors that are getting actually that cash, and the bank is actually being able to actually to do a better capital management and returns to its investors because those loans are no longer in its balance sheet.
It's interesting, isn't it? And do most, like are most of these mainstream banks like ASB and Westpac and ANZ and stuff like that, are they kind of all doing the exact same thing? Or do they kind of use more or less of securitization framework as time goes on? Or is it kind of, they all kind of do the same thing?
The banks in New Zealand, they have different liquidity strategies. So it's not so homogeneous across the whole banking sector. Especially for those, the biggest banks, the top four banks in New Zealand, they have some guidance from the regulator in terms of how much as a percentage of their funding that they have to do through cash deposits. And they have like ratios that the RBNZ here in New Zealand, they target to say, okay, you guys have to have, say, a minimum of 75%. So, making up the figure, it's close to that, but 75% of your ratio of your overall funding that needs to come from cash deposits, because cash deposits, you know, are relatively like more reliable form, because, you know, you don't take out all of your money off your bank in no time. Whereas a money market fund based in the US that is investing in New Zealand banks, in case of a stress, they may, right? So it's a different dynamic there. So when you take actually from those that like the wholesale market, some banks are much more versed and do much more often those off balance sheet securitizations amongst the New Zealand banks. And then they contract issuers to do that. But nowadays they have been doing a little bit less because the cost of capital has been so low over the last few years, decided to go straight the repo market, that is the market that is the wholesale market from the RBNZ, so where they pledge those directly to the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. They have been doing much less of the other ones, say in overseas markets where they create like bond facilities. But in a interest rate ramping up environment that we're going on right now, that balance act might actually change. Because if they find that they can actually finance themselves more cheaply in overseas markets compared to the short-term rate that they can get from, for example, the RBNZ, the official cash rate, then they might be more encouraged actually to go and issue bonds overseas.
Interesting. Yeah. So with the non-bank sector, a lot of the growth has probably happened through the use of securitization. And now if the banks are kind of incentivized to do that for various reasons, then it must be quite an active space. Is it quite a growing space out there where a lot more money now is coming from institutions to have indirectly fund lending activity through securitization?
It is. It's a very active market, and especially over the last few years, and since COVID, the bond issuance across the market has exploded. In the last 2 years, there hasn't been as much debt actually issued, both high yield and investment grade debt, as in the last 2 years. So absolutely, there's a big race to raise funds across the whole globe.
Awesome. Well, that is it for today. Sorry about that. That's all I'm going to share with you today from this conversation with Will Remore. Now, hopefully the audio quality didn't put you off too much. Maybe it wasn't that bad after all. Now, next week, we're going to build on this even more, and that's where it'll get really interesting. So you definitely don't want to miss that one. Central banks want retail banks to have a deep and diversified source of funding. Institutional investors want to be able to accurately assess risk and returns, and everyday investors just want a transparent seat at the table so they can play the game they're currently kind of locked out of. Investing in debt, democratization of debt. I think regulators and existing market participants need to genuinely look at blockchain technologies for what they are and ignore what they already think they are. NFTs, crypto, decentralized markets, distributed ledger technologies, these aren't gimmicks. These are just new tools that can help all of us transition fast into a world that may otherwise quickly leave us behind. Next week, Will's going to walk me through how securitization of debt can effectively mint non-fungible tokens and how all of that sandwich debt together can be on-sold to investors, which effectively provides a transparent investment option for everyday investors like you and me too. Now, one last thing before I leave you. Next week, I have a new introductory song. Don't be alarmed. It's still the same show. Actually, what I might do is I might even throw in the new jingle at the very end of this outro. Because I can, just to ease you into it so it's not so much of a shock. So I have this one specially made just for the show. It's not stock, and I hope that we enjoy it for at least a year before I get bored of it. So that's it for me today for this one. Hope you have a good one, and we'll catch you next time. Thanks for listening into the NZ Everyday Investor Podcast, a show that's about helping you, the everyday Kiwi, build wealth. To learn more about the show, please visit nzeverydayinvestor.com or visit your show notes on your podcast player. There, you can find out how to make contact, sign up to our newsletter, and check out previous episodes. We're on a mission to increase wealth for everyday Kiwis. If you'd like to support what we do, then there's a few things that you can do. Write a review on whatever platform you're listening to this on. Share episodes with your friends, or support us financially on Patreon. Before we finish up, Just another reminder that what was discussed today is for educational purposes only. Ideally, before acting on anything covered here, please contact your trusted financial advisor or do your own research. Hope you enjoyed today's episode, and we'll catch you next time around. We'll be right back.